Well, let me tell you just a little bit about myself. One is, I'm a little hoarse today. My wife and I were on a two-week vacation in Europe, which was great. Got home and I suddenly contracted a cold and bronchitis, and so I've been kind of resting a little bit in terms of this week, kind of make sure that I would be ready to come. And I was born in Texas, small town, Sweetwater, Texas, and went to college at Abilene Christian, majored in Bible there, and then went on and was the preacher for the Church of Christ in the New Haven, Connecticut area, where I also got a Master's Divinity degree from Yale. And then I came back and taught at Pepperdine for 10 years, got a PhD, and then I began a career in California Community Colleges, where I was president of two colleges. And I'm going to describe a little bit about how I got into politics. And perhaps that's one of the things that may help me in terms of talking to you a little bit about this whole business of a Christian's relationship to government. We're living in a pretty turbulent time. We get covered in the news a lot. There are a lot of protests that are going on. This one was one that occurred very recently after the election of President Trump. And this would just give you a little picture about what our present scene is about. In places also like Ferguson, Missouri, and Baltimore, Maryland, there were angry protests against alleged police brutality. And we have a rather sharply divided America. Perhaps there's some health in that, in the sense that we have a democracy and people can certainly express their views, which we're very grateful for. But we might get to thinking about, really, what about a Christian's relationship to government? Now, one thing I want to point out is that I'm not going to spend all the time talking. I'm going to talk for a while, present some of my views, and then I'm going to give you the opportunity to ask any questions, to disagree, to make any kind of observations that you'd like to make. I'd like to discuss these questions. What is a Christian's relationship to civil government? Can a Christian disobey the government? If so, under what circumstances? Should a Christian participate in civil government by voting, paying taxes, or work as a government employee? And then, can a Christian run for public office? If so, what kind of campaign should he or she conduct? What rules of behavior govern a Christian if elected? Those are the general topics that I want to talk about. Well, there is teaching in the New Testament about a Christian's relationship to government. And perhaps the one passage that deals with it, most is the one over in Romans 13. In that particular letter that Paul wrote, he said, "Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those authorities that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, whoever resists authority resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Pay to all for whom it is due them. Taxes to whom taxes are due. Revenue to whom revenue is due. Respect to whom respect is due. Honor to whom honor is due." Perhaps all of you are familiar with that passage. A very similar one is over in 1 Peter, where it says, "For the Lord's sake, accept the authority of every human institution, whether of the emperor as supreme or of governors as sent by him, to punish those who do wrong and to praise those who do right." Recall that the New Testament was written at a time when the Roman Empire ruled the Mediterranean world. And Christians naturally sometimes found themselves perhaps in opposition to some of the things that were happening. The Roman Empire in Palestine in the time of Jesus and also in the time of Paul, there was a very strong desire to rebel against the Roman Empire. There was a party called the Zealots. Sometimes they were spoken of as being the assassins because they were just anxious to rebel against the Roman Empire and to overthrow it. And they did rebel against the Roman Empire in 70 AD, but it was rather disastrous consequences because even though they held out for a period of time, eventually the Roman army surrounded Jerusalem, came in, completely tore down the temple, killed thousands of Jewish people, and led many thousands of others away into slavery. So that was the circumstance, and it was interesting that Paul, despite the fact that these were pagan rulers, says that, the authority actually comes from God. And what he really meant by that is, if there were no government, we'd have anarchy. Now, he wasn't saying, and we'll talk about this a little later, that every government is good. However, the Bible does not specify what form of government is ordained of God. Monarchy, autocracy, democracy, capitalism, socialism, you name it. Christianity was supposed to be able to exist whatever government existed. And therefore, it was not primarily an agency of rebellion. That it wasn't really... It had some revolutionary ideas, and we'll talk about those. I think there were implications that we have in the New Testament about certain practices. But we would simply say that in order for Christianity to be a completely neutral, in one sense, to be universal is what I'm really trying to say, if Christianity had been tied to any form of government, then it wouldn't have been able to be planted in all kinds of situations. And so we found Christianity, whether we would look in the Middle Ages, or whether we would look in monarchies, or whether we would look in a democratic state like the United States, or whether it's Western Europe, wherever it is, Christianity is not tied to any form of government specifically because it is mainly the kingdom of God, not the kingdom of the world. As I go on to say, furthermore, this does not suggest that every government is good and is in keeping with God's will. I wouldn't want to have to say that, for instance, the Nazi regime that existed in Germany and resulted in untold deaths was God's will. Other than the fact that perhaps as a result of that evil empire, certain good results came, but there were some disastrous results that came. So it's not trying to sanctify every government that exists. And, a Christian could say, personally, I think what is being done is evil. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a very well-known German theologian, returned to Germany. He had come to teach at Union Theological Seminary, but he felt it necessary because of the evil nature of the Nazi regime to go back to Germany. He said that if God calls a man to die, he should be willing to go. And so Bonhoeffer was a voice against the Nazi regime. And eventually he was executed, by the way, only a few short weeks prior to the liberation of Germany. But I don't, for instance, want to suggest that the communist regime in North Korea today is accomplishing the will of God. In fact, through his prophets, God often voiced his displeasure about certain kings of Israel and Judah. But what I'm simply trying to say here is that the existence of government, and I think we would all be in a bad situation if we decide, well, that the main thing we've got to do is, that what Christianity's got to do is establish the exact form of government that we've got to have, and so we get mixed up into that rather than mixed up into the business of spreading the kingdom of God. Biblical, now, here's the second question I want to race. Can a Christian disobey the government? And if so, under what circumstances? Generally speaking, we are to be obedient to our government. But there are occasions when both men of God and Christians were disobedient to government. In the Old Testament, we have, for instance, the fact that Elijah took issue with the rule of Ahab and Jezebel. Did it very forcefully, you recall, in the encounter with the prophets of Baal. And Jeremiah and Amos, all those prophets, if you read, they were quite willing to stand up. And sometime, in spite of great persecution, they were willing to stand up to the kings of Israel and Judah. And the passage I want to particularly cite is Acts 5 and 29. In the early days of the church in Jerusalem, they began to preach the message of Jesus. Well, the Sanhedrin, which was the Jewish ruling party at that time, were very offended by that. Why? Because they had been instrumental in the crucifixion of Jesus. They were the ones who tried Jesus and sent him on to Pilate with the recommendation that he be executed. And so they called Peter and the apostles in front of them, and they said, "Don't preach anymore in the name of Jesus." And the Peter and the apostles refused with this reply, "We must obey God rather than man." And that's a pretty simple rule. The civil government is to be obeyed under most circumstances. However, there are some circumstances in which we must obey God rather than man. Many early Christians were martyred because of their refusal to obey the command of the Roman Empire to worship the emperor. If you'll read the writings of many of the first and second century Christians, many of them lost their lives because of the fact that they were very adamant in their refusal to worship the emperor as a representative of God. Now, that doesn't mean they despised the emperor or tried to assassinate the emperor, but when the crucial point came, shall we obey God rather than man, they obeyed God. But it's very interesting, in the history of our own country, we were founded by a group of individuals who decided not to be obedient to the government under which they were under. If you know something about the American Revolution, they were at that time British subjects. They were colonists. It was a British colony, those 13 colonies, and they began to feel strongly that the British government was being tyrannical. Now, they did try to seek some peace with the British government. They didn't immediately go into an armed rebellion. But in 1775 at Concord and Lexington, you recall that a shot was fired, the whole ride of Paul Revere and all the rest. Well, how did those British colonists justify their behavior? What country can preserve the liberties if their rulers are not warned from time to time that their people preserve the right of resistance? Let them take up arms, one of our founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson, says. And this gentleman here, I happen to know a little bit about because I wrote my dissertation in American history because he was the only clergyman to sign the Declaration of Independence. And in this book that describes his views on moral philosophy, he said, "If the supreme power, wherever lodged, comes to be exercised in a manifestly tyrannical manner, the subjects may certainly, if in their power, resist and overthrow it." He was a Presbyterian minister who was, at that time, the president of Princeton University. And he said that you know, there's the possibility of actually taking up arms to overthrow the government. And there are other examples of this in American history. Perhaps the one that is the most notable in our own lifetime, I could cite the suffrage movement, the women who protested the fact that they weren't allowed to vote, and some of them were jailed and so forth. But in 1920, finally, the amendment was passed to the Constitution that permitted women to vote. But the civil rights movement was a movement that was ignited on December 1st, 1955, when someone did disobey the law of her city. Rosa Parks violated the Montgomery City Code by refusing to give up her seat to a white person on a city bus and subsequently was arrested. This led to the Montgomery bus boycott that eventually desegregated the buses. And then, of course, the individual who was most prominent was Martin Luther King, Jr. He was arrested 29 times for his challenges of the segregation laws of the South. Now recall, and many of you may recall this, that he did not do this violently. He made it very clear that we will simply go in, like restaurants that were segregated, we will go in and we will sit down at the restaurants. We will not, if they arrest us, we will not resist arrest. They were, in many cases, violently assaulted by dogs and water hoses and by whites that were very angry about it. But as a result of this peaceful but very strong disobedience, and the reason was that King made it very clear that these laws, in his judgment, were wrong, and that the only way that we're going to ever straighten out this wrong is to violate the law. We know through painful experiences that freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed. So we're simply pointing out this. And I would conclude it by saying, however, disobeying law is not to be done carelessly. One should seek to change the law through lawful procedures before resorting to civil disobedience. Normally, one should be subject to governing authorities. Okay, let's turn now to the third question that I want to talk about, and that is, should a Christian participate in civil government by voting, paying taxes, or work as a government employee? Now, most of you might say, well, the answer to that's pretty simple, yes. Well, that wasn't always the view of everyone in the Churches of Christ. David Lipscomb, editor of the Gospel Advocate and founder of the Nashville Bible School, which later became David Lipscomb College, believed that Christians should not vote or go to war. He believed strongly in the strict separation between the kingdom of God and the kingdom of the world. And there have been many Christians who have held this view through the ages. The Mennonites, the Amish, for instance, are illustrations of that. In a well-known book that I have here, it's kind of well-worn, but it's called Christ and Culture, an outstanding book that dealt with the whole theme of how Christian churches dealt with culture through the ages. Were they opposed to culture? Were they above culture in trying to dominate culture, like, say, the popes of the Middle Ages? Or were they subservient to culture, simply being a part of culture? Or did they attempt to transform culture? So that's been a really interesting idea down through the ages. And he labels this approach of someone like David Lipscomb as being a separatist approach. Now, what would be wrong with that approach? Well, the only question I might ask about it is, how can a Christian be the light of the world and the salt of the earth if he or she completely withdraws from the world? In Christ and Culture, Niebuhr took issue with this position, saying the movement of withdrawal and renunciation is a necessary element of every Christian life. In other words, it's true. You can't be simply controlled by your culture. You've got to be willing to stand against the culture, Love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. But he said it must be followed by an equal necessary movement, a responsible engagement in cultural tasks. And there are biblical examples of those who were involved in government. Joseph, as you recall, was second in command to the Pharaoh of Egypt. David was a king. Erastus is referred to as a city treasurer in Romans 16:23. Now, there would be times when I think it would be wrong for a Christian to engage in a government that was an evil government. And I've cited, of course, the idea of Nazi Germany. But there are some ways in which a government, how could someone might say, why would a government engage in the dirty world of politics? Well, of course, you might want to ask the question, if good men and women refuse to hold public office, to whom do we leave these offices by default? Actually, there are good deeds that can be performed largely by government. In other words, we can do things on an individual basis, but sometimes things have to be done on a governmental basis, on a social basis. Slavery could not have been abolished in the United States by simply doing it one person at a time, because there had been many slave owners that just frankly would not have followed that rule. So finally, it was abolished by the Emancipation Proclamation in the 13th Amendment. The same thing was true of racial segregation. It was abolished by a series of civil rights laws. And often acts of mercy can be supplemented by governmental actions to care for the disabled, the poor, the elderly. Martin Luther King, I thought, had a good quote when he said, "Compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. It comes to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring." What he's really saying is, you know, there might be situations in which we're creating a lot of beggars by the way in which we have structured the government. And if we would restructure the government in a more compassionate way, we would have fewer beggars. So it's helpful to individually care for people, but it's also much of what has been done in America has been acts of compassion by the government. Actually, justice is a central command in the Bible. Let justice run down like water and righteousness like a mighty stream. Well, you might guess I would get finally to my own personal experience. I'm not totally objective in this matter because I did run for office. And it was rather unexpected. I was president of Pasadena City College at the time. And a group of people came to me and they said, "We've all been talking and we want to ask you to run for the California State Assembly." And my first response was, I said, "Well, I don't much think I want to do that. I'd have to raise money. Unfortunately, when you're running in a place where you've got 400,000 people, you can't contact everybody by knocking on the door." And so after thinking about it and praying about it and consulting with my family, I decided to run, and I served in the Assembly and then later in the Senate. And I was able to author 146 bills that were signed into law. I think a lot of those were good bills. I think they were bills that helped people's lives. I remember, for instance, seniors that were being abused, I thought, by annuity salespersons. They were knocking on a door, and the salesperson would come into a senior and begin to pitch an annuity. And before he walked out with a healthy commission, and somebody had bought an annuity. I put in a rule that for a senior citizen, you had to give them a 24-hour notice so that they could give somebody a call and say, "Wait a minute, somebody's come to see me." Call his son or daughter and say, "Would you come in and sit with me and help me understand what this is all about?" I dealt with bills tried to improve schools a great deal because I was the chair of the education committee. I had a bill about gun safety that said, in effect, that someone who had a concealed weapon without a permit, that person could be tried for either a misdemeanor or a felony, because before that they could only be tried for a misdemeanor. Well, a lot of gang members who were carrying guns and shouldn't have had the right to carry guns were tried as a result of that. I carried a whole book, a lot of bills that dealt with issues, and I'll be glad to talk a little bit about that, but protection for seniors, health care. So I felt like I was able to do some things that worked to the good. Now, here's what I think are the rules for how you ought to run for office. Avoid attacking opponents with insults or personal attacks. Now, I know this sounds rather strange in our day and age. And in the recent campaign, we had some pretty harsh things, liars and all everything else people were called. Well, you know, the Bible does say, and when Jesus was teaching in the Sermon on the Mount, he talked against insulting other people. Don't call your brother a rock or a fool or anything like that. I had discussions and arguments with fellow legislators, but I always talked about issues. I don't remember ever calling anybody a liar. I don't remember ever attacking anybody personally. I felt like what we need to do is discuss things in a civil manner. So I think if you're going to, you avoid attacking opponents with insults or personal attacks. I also said that every campaign material that was to be sent out, I would first have to put my stamp of approval on it. That I would not allow anything to go out that was untrue. I had not checked the facts very carefully. Be careful about campaign promises. Make sure they're doable and that you intend to follow through. And be gracious in both victory and defeat. You know, be willing to pick up the phone and call your opponent if you lost and say congratulations, and if I can be of help, let me be of help. The bitterness and the harshness that marks a lot of campaigns in our day and age is frankly, I think, unchristian. And if you have any idea of running for office, try to avoid that. That doesn't mean you can't point out the weakness of your opponent. But it does mean I recall one time picking up a piece of literature about myself and I couldn't recognize it. Because it wasn't true. And so that's just a rule of thumb. Can a Christian run for public office? What kind of campaign? What kind of behavior once you get in office? Here was the biblical passage that I thought was about as good as any. What does God require of you but to do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God? Always recognize that your primary allegiance is to God, not to your party, your constituents, or your future political career. When I was studying at Yale, I remember my Christian ethics professor had a little saying. He said, you know, you can connect yourself with institutions, but always ride loose in the saddle. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that? Well, here's what it meant. Always be willing to not have to take your orders from somebody else. Do not ride loose in the saddle. Now, that's true. I remember I taught a course in business ethics once, and I said, I want you to sit down on a piece of paper and write down what would your superiors ask of you that you would be unwilling to do or be willing to lose your job about. So I waited a while, and I said, if your page is blank, you're in trouble. Because you've got to realize there are some things I will not do. Now, you know, whether a road goes here or there is a matter of opinion. I don't think there's a moral issue in whether a road goes here or there. But I think that there are some things that you've got to check out. All right, be careful in making promises. Your credibility with your voters and fellow legislators is very important. Follow this advice. Speak out for those who cannot speak, for the rights of all the destitute. Speak out, judge righteously, defend the rights of the poor and needy. Folks, the wealthy and the powerful always have somebody to speak up for them. Somebody's got to speak up for those who don't have a voice, who need somebody to stand up for them, because they're not people of power. They're just your constituents. They're people. In the Bible, if it teaches anything, it teaches us that we ought to care about the poor, the needy, those who are lacking, those who are on the margins of society. Jesus, when he taught, you remember in the 25th chapter of Matthew, in the last day, how was he going to judge us? When I was hungry, you gave me to eat. When I was thirsty, you gave me to drink. When I was naked, you clothed me. When I was sick and in prison, you visited me. Recognize the temptation of power and pride. Victor Havel, president of the Czech Republic, stated this fact well. Being in power makes me permanently suspicious of myself. There's something treacherous, elusive, and ambiguous in the temptation of power. And that's very true. I don't care whether it's a city council, a school board, an assembly, a Congress, or president. There's the temptation that you're now in power and you're something about you is pretty special. Well, not really. I remember sometime I'd be walking down the State Capitol Hall and sometime people say, "Hello, Senator Scott. How are you, Senator Scott?" And I'd think to myself, you know, one day you're just going to be Jack Scott, just like you were before you got up here. And you're not going to be Senator Scott. That can be very deceptive. In fact, I was very lucky to be asked to run, to be elected. I can say lucky. I hope it was the providence of God because I prayed about it. But all I'm saying is you've got to keep your feet on the ground because there is a seduction that comes. It's old Lord Acton had a phrase when he said that power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. So that's kind of what I wanted to talk about today. Now, what are your questions? What would you like to comment on? Yes.
I had a question about when you're serving with the government and, for example, the gay marriage issue.
Yes.
And there was a couple of county clerks, one in Florida and one in Kentucky, that didn't feel like they could issue their licenses because of their religious beliefs. And I was wondering if what your comments about that, because I think one is still in the process and one did go to jail. About that, and they were both fired, and they have county lawsuits, and so on.
Well, let me tell you the way I would solve that problem. I would say, number one, to separate my job as an official from my own personal views. For instance, if I were a judge, and I didn't believe in capital punishment, and yet that particular crime called for capital punishment, I would think my job as a judge would be to go ahead and carry that out. I think if you feel you can't carry something out, then you shouldn't serve in that role. For instance, let's take the issue of marriage. When somebody comes and has been divorced three times and ran off with somebody other than his wife, and I'm the judge and he presents himself to be married to this woman, it's not my job there to say, "Oh, wait a minute, I don't think you should have left your wife, so I'm not going to give you a marriage certificate," because I'm a public official at that point. Now, if I happen to be a personal friend of the man, I could pull him off to the side and tell him what I thought. But I don't think you can... In other words, if you're a police officer, you have to carry out you have to exercise force. So if you can't do something that job calls upon you to do, then don't do it. But I think a lot of times people can't separate the difference between what's illegal and what's immoral. There are things that are, for instance, I use the person who, lying is immoral. Lying is not illegal. It is if you're in court and you're committing perjury. It is if you're, but I could tell you a story terribly exaggerated, like that really happened to me, and I would think that would be wrong for me to do, but it's not illegal. Yes.
Are there situations, like she mentioned, where a person could recuse themselves from that particular decision and yet maintain the position as a public servant?
I think, and I'm not sure, but I think in one of those states, I believe it's Alabama, the woman who refused to do it, she had the right to allow another official in that office to to give the license, but she didn't want to allow that to happen. So I'm not sure. But all I'm saying is I think you have to recognize that you're not, when I'm it's like, you know, if I'm a police officer and I think that maybe there might be some law that I think wasn't a very wise law, but I couldn't refuse to go ahead and enforce it. Now, if that law called upon me to violently beat somebody, that'd be another matter. But I'm saying, I think there can be a way of thinking that through. And but that's a difficult question. I understand that. And then, you know, I think any time you get, there is a value to a separated view. When you separate yourself, you don't have to get your hands dirty. And if you become a public official, you've got to decide, okay, here are the things I'm willing to do as a public official. I may not totally agree with this law, but I'm going to go ahead and enforce the law. But on the other hand, there might be some things you say I just cannot do, and therefore I won't seek that office.
Jen?
Yeah.
I guess for me, both sides, left wing, right wing, whatever you want to call them, call themselves Christians. Mm-hmm. And that's, I just quit watching the news. it's just none. But yet, both sides, I think there is some compassion on both sides, and there's some radicalness on both sides. Both sides have insulted each other when you're talking to Madonna or Trump. You know, they both have done it. And yet, they both call themselves Christians. And that, to me, I'm confused, I guess. I don't know. You know,
well, let me tell you. I don't think the fact that somebody calls themselves right. Christian means they're actually a Christian.
Right. Sure.
And I don't have to, you know, I mean, I'm not, and I could cite rules on both sides of the issue, you know. Let's talk about prejudice, for instance. For instance, Clinton said he was a Christian, but I don't think what he did with Monica Lewinsky was a Christian act. And on the other hand, I don't think a lot of things Donald Trump has said is Christian. I think he says harsh and ugly things that he could say, and I think he at times says things that aren't exactly true. He just says them. He says it without thinking, I think. I don't think he's deliberately lying, but I think he's at least I would be more cautious about what I wanted to say. So I don't think that merely the fact that somebody claims to be a Christian doesn't mean that I automatically label them as a Christian, because everybody knows that, you know, to put on a pious act maybe wins votes. And I'm a little, you know, Jesus was pretty clear about this business of putting religion on your sleeve in order to impress people. Don't do your alms before people. Don't pray with loud protestations and so forth. So, yes, I let people know that I was a Christian. On occasions, for instance, in the Senate, they begin it with a prayer. They would ask me to lead the prayer because they knew my background. But I was pretty cautious about waving the Christian flag, you know. There's something about that I'd rather let people be around me a while and say, you know, some way or another way that person behaves seems to me that he's a Christian, rather than piously proclaiming to be a Christian. And then suddenly, you know, they catch me with a prostitute or something like that. And that has happened more than once. Yes.
Well, I'd like to get back to protests, okay?
Oh, good, okay.
As an experienced legislator, what kind of public pressure does one respond to?
That's a really good question, and I like to talk to people about that, because I think protests can make a difference. I mean, I think clearly, I mean, if we talk about the civil rights movement, think about, I'm not sure that a lot of that would have happened if they hadn't have had a civil rights movement, and those people demonstrated that it meant a great deal to them, the kind of insults that African Americans had suffered down through the ages. And so they just weren't going to merely say, oh, that's all right. I won't eat in the restaurants. I won't go to the restrooms. I won't get to go to your universities. They logically made some protest about that. In fact, one of the outstanding lawyers in the Martin Luther King operation was Fred Gray, who's a member of the Church of Christ. Yeah. And he was very, very successful. And I think that he had every right to bring the suits that they brought because I think it was a great injustice. You know, when I grew up in a segregated town, and I never will forget when finally, about age 16 or 17, I looked around and I thought to myself, you know, the Bible says something about doing unto others as you should have them doing to you. And that's not the way I want to be treated. And therefore, I shouldn't treat somebody else that way. So I think those kind of protests were helpful. When people came to my office, when they would come to my office and present a legitimate concern, I listened to them. Now, I didn't like for anybody to come to me and shake their fist at me and tell me that I was a lousy, no-count guy and so forth like that. It's just like anybody, if you're going to try to change somebody, you try to respectfully present your, even if it's an opposing view. But I think protests make a difference. And I think they're, now, I don't think looting, I don't think stealing, or I don't think burning or any of that, I don't think that helps at all. I think that's counterproductive. But I do think that a protest, yes.
And yet, everything you mentioned also occurred during the time of King, as you know.
Oh, yeah.
And the other thing that's an element that we don't often think about is that even King's protests were not successful without publicity. Case in point.
Without the what?
Publicity.
Oh, sure.
A case in point, in 1962, he was in Albany, Georgia. And the Albany movement involved just as much injustice, just as much black people being disenfranchised, but it fell flat on its face. You know why? The chief of police, Laurie Pritchard, had studied Gandhi, and he had studied King. And so when they arrested the protesters who were doing these legitimate protests, they did so ever so politely. This way to the paddy wagon. No abuse. So it's very interesting. And so by the time they get to Birmingham, you have Bull Connor, who's just a nut, as you know.
Yeah.
And so it's this very interesting sort of thing, because on the one hand, you don't want people to act out. But King knew the movement would not be successful unless his enemies acted like enemies.
So exactly.
It's kind of ironic in some ways.
You know, I have to tell you, one of the things that I sometimes have quoted in the life of Jesus is when he said, be harmless as doves, but wise as serpents. So once in a while, I thought being savvy, being wise, King was very wise, realizing that if you have somebody who overreacts against you, that the publicity, this, of course, touched the hearts of white people, because they said those poor folks are being, you know, fire hoses and police dogs, and they're being, children are being beaten and so forth. No question. I mean, I'm not saying that you can't use publicity to get your point across. What I said was, is if the it was when the protesters get out of control,
absolutely.
But when the police, the law enforcement get out of control. For instance, let's take Ferguson, Missouri. That was a very difficult situation, and I won't go into who's right and who's wrong. But I'll tell you, they had a tinderbox when it was a 60% African American town. And the police force was about 53-6 white.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, right away, it doesn't take a lot of sense to figure that one out. You're setting yourself up for a situation that's going to one day explode on you. So, you know, I've been in administration. I've been president of a college. And when I saw a problem stirring, I tried to go and solve it right away. Because I knew that, you know, pretty soon a small fire can become a conflagration because you haven't been smart enough to put out the fire early. So your point's well taken.
Well, and I just want to add this real quick point. But, and yet King, though, no matter what was going on, ever dehumanize his opponent. And so whenever Medgar Evers was murdered in Mississippi, he said, "Our white brothers and sisters, some of them are sick, and we must redeem some of our sick white brothers and sisters." But there was never, that's why I was really struck by this wonderful presentation of yours. Are you running for president? because it was never dehumanizing. No matter what the opponent did, they were always brother and sister. And I think that was a part of his power.
Yeah.
Well, don't mean to set you up on this, but I think it's important for Christians to understand. I remember growing up, the different positions of the Republican Party and the Democratic Party and the religious aspect of both positions. You have, you yourself have witnessed that, and I have good friends who are Christians who serve in Congress and all that type of great guy, who's a House of Representative person out of Kentucky, is a Christian. He told me the other day he received the Most Kind Award for being over there. He said, "Great, I don't know if that's good or not." How do you balance, how should Christians balance your wisdom on this? Party platforms with regard to what they are associated with and still maintaining the Christian elevation that we should have?
Well, I don't think that any platform, Republican or Democrat, that whoever's running has to say that I subscribe to every tenet of that platform. I don't want to have to stand. I was a Democrat in the legislature. But that didn't mean that everything that that the Democrats stood for, I had to stand for. For instance, I never felt like that gambling was a good solution for Indian tribes. And I feel very sympathetic with the plight of the American Indian, but I'm not a great fan of gambling. I think it's not something that's... So I didn't vote for it. Now, most of my legislative friends on both sides of the aisle actually voted for it. But I just simply told the head of my caucus, I said, "You know, John, I don't believe in that, and you know, I'm not going to vote for that." And so I didn't. You know, and so, you know, you can, I think if you are willing, you know, and I think you don't have to be terribly self-righteous about it. I think you can simply say that's just not something I'm going to go along with, and over time people respect you for that. Go ahead.
And I'm sorry. How did you handle if your constituents wanted yes and you voted no?
Yeah.
Oh, I'll tell you how I handled it. I'm sure in some cases now, of course, it's, you do that too often, you won't be elected. I understand that. But on the other hand, let me say this. If you are a person that comes across as a person of integrity, you might be surprised that people that will say, "You know, I don't agree with Jack on that issue," and so forth and so on. "But, you know, he's a good person, and I'm going to go ahead and vote for him." You don't always have to, you know, you can, if you come, I'll tell you, one of the things that's most important in politics is for people to respect you and to like you. You know, if you're not very likable, people are just not going to vote for you. That's the truth of the matter. Now, you know, that's fine if you're not a likable person, be an artist. Or, you don't have to get into politics, you know. But I'm just saying, that's kind of what I would say. And even when... You know, I've had people, when I was in an audience, I've had people kind of come at me a little bit. And if I say, "Well, thank you for your opinion. I can't quite agree with you on that. I see what you're talking about. Let me point out my viewpoint on this." And I'm not saying I won them over, but I didn't have to say, "What in the world did you say that?" You know, I'm just saying that. Did you always say
that? Well,
he said, "What
we're on the same wavelength." I was going to say the same thing.
Okay, yes. And we'll have to close out here in about 2 minutes.
So yeah. I was wondering if your general commentary on the establishment and free expression clause of the First Amendment about religious freedom. And it seems sometimes to me that the religious freedom seems to get the short end of the stick a lot of times with political situations. And I wonder if you could comment on that.
Well, of course, I think one of the beauties of the Constitution is that we started off with separation of church and state. I mean, that's just, and I have not been in agreement with individuals, ministers who decide they're going to cast all their lot with one party or the other, and so forth. I think they've done it. That's a pretty dangerous thing. I don't want to wrap. I'm an American, and I believe I'm patriotic, but I don't think Christianity needs to have the American flag wrapped around it, because I believe that, first of all, when I go into Germany or when I go into Kenya or wherever I go, they're not interested in whether I'm an American or not. They're interested in whether I'm a Christian or not. So that's all I would say. I'd say that we ought to keep these things separate. That doesn't mean you can't express your moral opinions on certain things. I understand that. But never say to somebody, well, now listen, if you're a Christian, you've got to vote this way. Yeah. Or, you know, you've got to vote that way. Or, you know, in Jesus Christ, Paul said, you're neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female. And I'd add a little bit, didn't it? Democrat or Republican, American or Chinese, black or white, none of those things. You are in Jesus Christ. Okay, thank you very much.